Support for Central Florida Public Media comes from Addition Financial, offering their Savings Plus account with a 4% annual percentage yield. Serving Central Floridians since 1937 and was recently named one of Newsweek's best regional credit unions. More at additionfi.com/NPR. Applicable on savings up to $5,000. Rate subject to change, federally insured by NCUA.
Climate change on Earth and Mars. You're listening to Are We There Yet? The radio show exploring space exploration. Hi, I'm Brendan Byrne. NASA says last month was the hottest on record based on temperature data dating back to the 1880s. The agency uses a fleet of climate sensors here on the ground and in space. We'll speak with NASA's Gavin Schmidt about how scientists measure this climate data and what it's showing us about climate change. Then, Earth's changing climate isn't unique. Scientists are uncovering the climate history of Mars. We'll speak with Mars expert and University of Florida scientist Amy Williams about the red planet's temperature history and what it might tell us about what's to come here on Earth. That's ahead on Are We There Yet? According to NASA data, last month was 2.1 degrees Fahrenheit warmer than the average July between 1951 and 1980, and the hottest July on record dating back to 1880. Parts of South America, North Africa, North America, and the Antarctic Peninsula were especially hot, experiencing temperature increases 7 degrees above average. Extreme heat this summer put tens of millions of people under heat warnings and was linked to hundreds of heat-related illnesses and deaths. These warmer temperatures are part of a trend of long-term human-driven climate change, fueled by greenhouse gas emissions. Tracking these temps and the planet's changing climate is Gavin Schmidt, director of NASA's Goddard Institute for Space Studies. He joins us now to talk about the agency's efforts to measure the planet's temperature. Gavin, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
So NASA released a report that July was the hottest month on record. Tell us a bit about what you have found with this new temperature record.
Yeah, so we keep track of temperatures using weather stations, ocean ships, buoys, satellites, and we as part of the monitoring that NASA does of the whole Earth system, and we've been doing the surface temperature anomalies since the 1980s, and we've been able to extend that record back to the 19th century. And what we've seen since the 1980s, of course, is that the globe has been warming. Those temperatures have been pretty much steadily rising. What we find and what we've just found is that this July was by far the warmest July on record, way more than the statistical uncertainty in these estimates. Because July and August are generally the warmest months in the calendar year, and that's because of, you know, where the continents are placed and the bias towards the hemispheres, that means that this July is the warmest month in absolute terms that we've ever seen. And that goes back, you know, clearly 150 years, but we have indirect evidence that suggests that it might be the warmest month for a much longer period, maybe even thousands of years.
I live here in Florida, Gavin, so anecdotally, I can tell you that it's been the hottest that I can remember. You've got empirical evidence that shows us this. It sounds like when you see something like that, that's alarming that this is the hottest on record. What does it actually mean in the big picture of this changing climate?
Right. I mean, so it's an indication of that changing climate. You know, I mean, we're seeing this most clearly in temperatures. And now, it used to be that we would only talk about this in the global mean. It's like, well, in the global average, we're seeing this change, and that's been true since the 1980s. But the magnitude of the change now is such that it's directly evident in local temperatures. You mentioned Florida, but we're seeing it in the American Southwest. We're seeing it in North Africa. We're seeing it in the Middle East. We're seeing it in Asia. This month, there was only two places in the world that were normal, which was the Midwest and parts of Northern Europe. You know, pretty much everywhere else was warm, and a lot of that area was record warm. You know, this is an indication of what's happening, and as things continue to get warmer, we expect more and more records to get broken, and so we're not surprised that these records are being broken, but it's still shocking to see, because the records are being broken by very large amounts, not by tiny little things that we could argue about. I mean, but by a very large amount.
The NASA itself is a federal agency, right? And this Biden administration has put the changing climate and climate change one of its priorities. What is NASA's role in monitoring and mitigating this changing climate?
Right. So first off, NASA is a science agency. It's not a policy agency. It doesn't regulate anything. It doesn't control anybody or anything. It's a science agency. And we have many, many assets. So we have instruments on the space station. We have satellites flying in low Earth orbit. We have satellites in very far orbits, so we can get a big picture of the whole sphere. And we're measuring all sorts of things. We're measuring ozone levels and winds and cloudiness and radiation and temperature and the surface salinity of the ocean and the soil moisture and the height of trees, the height of the ice sheets, and how the gravity, the total mass of the ice sheets, and how that's changing over time. And so we're looking, and we are the agency, I think, that has the most comprehensive set of information about what's happening on the planet. And we use that to interpret what we're seeing and to build models and to make projections and to kind of attribute why things are changing. So we're not just looking at the changes, we're looking at the causes of those changes. So we're keeping track of the impacts of the Hunga Tonga eruption on stratospheric water vapor. We're keeping track of contrails and ship tracks and aerosol emissions in the North Atlantic. And all of these things kind of play a role. But the dominant driver for those trends over the last 40 years is our emissions of greenhouse gases and mostly carbon dioxide and methane. So our role as an agency is to kind of see what's happening, put the pieces together, and give people the tools that allow them to make better decisions, hopefully.
Going back to what we first started talking about, the hottest temperatures since 1880, that's a date that's before the agency even existed. You mentioned that you made some inferences. How do you get data that far back, or how do you paint that picture so that we can make these comparisons over hundreds of years?
Right. So we have good weather records from about the mid-19th century. So that was when, people really started thinking about what it is that you're supposed to do when you take the temperature. You don't put it out in the sun, you put it in a shaded thing. And that you had a large enough network so that you could say, well, what's happening in the Southern Hemisphere? What's happening in Africa? What's happening in South America? What's happening in North? And so we kind of have to, even though the thermometer was invented in the 17th century, it took about 200 years for enough thermometers to be spread around the world so that we could be able to judge, what any one year was doing, whether it was warmer or colder and things like that. So, we've been able to extend our records back in time because a lot of these old records have been newly digitized. And so there's actually an increasing amount of data that's being kind of pulled out of the old archives that we're able to use, which is a fascinating citizen science project if you're interested. People can go back and decode these old logbooks, and then that gets incorporated into the next update of these temperature records.
Oh, that's really cool. So you can, citizen scientists are helping you establish these records then, huh?
Yeah, there's a website called oldweatherrecords.com. com, maybe .org, and you can go there, and they'll just, you know, and lots of people check. So lots of people do the same logbook page, and where there are discrepancies, they go back and look at it. But people have been able to digitize millions and millions of records that we would not have been able to do without the citizen science component.
Mm-hmm. One of the really cool things about NASA, Gavin, is one that, you know, that citizen science initiatives that you see throughout the agency, but also the fact that this data is available to, most of this data is available to pretty much everyone. But there's so much data. How do you make this accessible to someone like me, who is not a climate scientist, who is not an analytical person? What is NASA's strategy to communicate what's actually happening out there?
So we do a lot of press briefings. If you go to our website, which is data.gis.nasa.gov, you'll see a link to the temperature of things, and you can slice it, you can compare it to the 1930s, you can look at the trends, you can look at what's happening like in your house, right? And if you want to go the next level down, all the code is there, all the sources of the data are there, so you can reproduce this. You could even scoop us if you want to do. All of this stuff is there. The graphics are pretty good. And you can see, you know, what's happening on land and the ocean, and, you know, in the hemisphere, what's happening in the spring, what's happening in the summer. And we keep track of those things, and we try and make those as useful as possible for people.
Mm-hmm. Gavin, you mentioned that a lot of this data is from kind of weather stations and buoys. But, you know, when I think of NASA, I think of, you know, rockets and satellites and all that. Can you talk a little bit about kind of the top-down observations that NASA makes, and what tools you have in orbit that are helping you measure the changing climate?
Right. So we haven't had satellites in orbit for that long, you know, only since about 1979 for many of them, and only since about 2000 for some of the most sophisticated. And so we don't have as long a satellite record as we would like, right, to really give what's happening that kind of long-term context. But we are able to compare what we're seeing over the last 40 years from satellites to what we're inferring from the surface. And so that's very much part of what we do. We always like to have multiple ways of looking at the same phenomena so that we can be sure that what we're seeing is real and not just an artifact of the processing or of some issue in the data. So we do look at the satellite data. So we have one instrument on AURA, which is called the AIRS instrument, which is an infrared spectrometer, and that allows us to, by looking at specific frequencies, it allows us to see, you know, what's happening for surface temperature anomalies, what's happening in the mid atmosphere, and other things there, and that, when you line it up with what we see in the surface, you know, the ups and downs and the ups are captured very credibly. There are independent satellite measurements, so there are ones that measure the kind of the weighted temperature of the whole atmosphere called using microwaves, and they use the microwave sending unit, and again, you know, you see those same trends, and you see particularly for this July these absolutely exceptional temperatures.
And Gavin, finally, I'm going to ask you this question, knowing that, you know, NASA is not a policy agency, it's a measuring agency, but as a scientist yourself, with all of this data, and this data being public and being out there, and people are seeing this changing climate, are you optimistic as a scientist that we can get ahead of this and maybe stop some of the effects of climate change?
So part of what we do is ingest all this information. You know, we create models, we make projections. And one of the things that we have found relatively recently is that we control the future. Almost all of the trends that we've seen so far have been because of our actions. But it turns out that the trends for the future are really a function of our actions in the future. And so if we were to stop emitting carbon dioxide tomorrow, global warming would stop. It would stabilize. It would not get any warmer. And so while, you know, stopping everything tomorrow is not realistic, the faster we move towards a what's called net zero, which is like we're not putting any more carbon dioxide into the atmosphere than we're taking out. The faster we move to net zero, the faster we can stabilize global temperatures. But they're not going back down, right? So what we have now could be the new normal if we get emissions under control.
Gavin Schmidt is the director of NASA's Goddard Institute for Space Studies. Gavin, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Still to come, climate change isn't unique to just our planet. A look at Mars and its changing climate. That's ahead on Are We There Yet?
Support for Central Florida Public Media comes from Addition Financial, offering their Savings Plus account with a 4% annual percentage yield. Serving Central Floridians since 1937 and was recently named one of Newsweek's best regional credit unions. More at additionfi.com/NPR. Applicable on savings up to $5,000. Rate subject to change, federally insured by NCUA.
You're listening to Are We There Yet? I'm Brendan Byrne. Earth's changing climate isn't unique. Scientists are uncovering the climate history of Mars. It's done with the help of robotic rovers like NASA's Perseverance rover. And here to talk more about the red planet's climate history, its effect on the search for signs of life, and what we can learn from our planetary neighbor is Amy Williams. She's an astrobiologist at the University of Florida and scientist working on NASA's Perseverance rover. Amy, welcome back to the show.
Hi, thanks so much. Always fun to chat with you about Mars and Earth and whatever else.
That's right. So Mars and Earth. So we're going to talk about this climate study that's happening, this study of Mars climate. But we've talked about this before. Amy, just remind me, why is it so interesting to study Mars kind of in relation to Earth? Why do they work out to be two great comparisons?
So you might sometimes hear that Venus is actually Earth's twin. And that's true in some ways with regards to the size of the planets. But when it comes to thinking about Mars and comparing it to Earth, Mars is really great because, number one, it's a place that we can more readily explore with robotic explorers. And so that ends up being really important for helping us to understand how these two worlds, Earth and Mars, and, you know, we can keep Venus in there as well if we want to, how they all started out relatively similarly very early on in the solar system. And all three worlds have actually diverged in their planetary evolution in really extraordinary ways, right? Like Earth is the only one we know has life. You know, Venus has now this runaway greenhouse system. And, you know, there's been a discussion, was there ever life on Venus? Could it be in the clouds? All of these really compelling questions. And then you end up with the same kind of question with Mars. Was there life in the past on Mars? And now it is this cold, dry desert. So again, all these worlds kind of started out very similarly, but they have diverged so greatly in their evolution.
And you can come to that conclusion listening to, you know, our conversations, right? I mean, when we talk about where Perseverance is in a river delta. We talk about plateaus. We talk about all of these kind of terrestrial things that we have here on Earth, right? Because essentially, it is a rocky planet, right?
That's exactly right. Yeah, you know, the inner rocky worlds are all formed from generally the same kind of, you know, pool of material as the solar system was forming. And so, you know, we look for cores and mantles and crusts in those worlds. But the proportions of the elements in those different, you know, layers, might vary between the worlds. And one of the big things that's so interesting about Earth relative to these other worlds is that we have a magnetic shield, right? Like we have our magnetosphere that protects us in ways that these other worlds, Mars especially, does not have anymore.
So let's talk about the climate differences then. We know Venus is pretty hellish. Mars is pretty hellish for us, right? For organisms like ourselves. What do we know about the history of Mars's climate and how did it get to where it is today?
Yeah. So depending on who you talk to, I think everyone can agree that there was water on Mars in its distant past. But depending on who you talk to, I think that's when you start to run into controversy, because the question is, was it a cold and wet Mars, or was it a warm and wet Mars? And, you know, we know there was liquid water, so we know there's certain temperatures and pressures that were met on the surface early on in its history. Now, when the water dried up, that's one of the big questions that, you know, we hope Mars Sample Return can help us with, because you can get an absolute date in the billions of years of when these, you know, rock layers were laid down that were formed by water. So that's one thing that would give us, you know, a really strong benchmark to say, okay, we know there's water flowing at this particular age. And that can tell us, did water dry up relatively early? Was it actually flowing episodically further on into, you know, Mars's history? So that's one of the things that we want to explore with Mars Sample Return.
I was going to say, I figured the answer was going to be trapped in those rocks, right? So, I mean, what do we know about it? What are some of the challenges that scientists are running into without having those samples to actually, I mean, you say that this is an open question, right? When did this happen? Was it hot, cold? We don't know when this happened. What are the challenges in figuring that out with robotic explorers like Perseverance or Curiosity?
Yeah, so without having the ability to get, you know, absolute dates on these rocks, which is something that we do in our labs here on Earth pretty routinely, you can't say there's, you know, a specific time, like the last water that flowed in this area on Mars was 3.8 billion years ago, right? That's our estimate, but we don't have a good benchmark to link that to. And all of this always, you know, goes back to life as we know it tends to require water. And so we often look for the water. We look for sources of carbon, all of these things that could support an environment where life would want to live, what we call a habitable environment. And as we see in these articles, as we hear about, you know, modern Mars is a, you know, you said Venus is very hellish. Well, Mars is sort of when hell froze over, right? So it is this really cold, dry desert now. And so it, again, is in part this, what appears to be almost this global climatic shift from water being on the surface to moving towards the cold and dry desert that we know today. And all of Mars, you know, was subject to this dramatic climatic shift over some period of time. And you know, like we don't have good time benchmarks to say exactly when that happened. And that becomes so important when you think about when might life have arisen on Mars, if it did. And how long did it have to be, you know, in the surface or near surface before the environment became so dramatically inhospitable that, you know, that life, maybe it died out, maybe it went to the subsurface to protect itself, or maybe it was never there.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, is climate one of those important things that you need to consider as an astrobiologist when looking for these ancient signs of life? Is climate kind of one of the variables as to whether or not life could have existed at any given time on that planet?
Oh, absolutely. You know, and we have models that help us to understand what is likely. And so that's a lot of what we rely on is developing these climate models, looking at how you might have had circulation in the atmosphere between the atmosphere and the hydrosphere on Mars when there was water on the surface. And again, it all links back to, you know, did you have the environments that were conducive not only to origin of life, but to sustaining that life over an extended period?
You mentioned Mars had water, could have had this environment that sustained life. Why is it so important to understand the climate there? Is this kind of a warning as to what might happen to our planet? Is that a good reason to be studying the climate of Mars and also Venus? You know, you mentioned runaway greenhouse effect. Are these kind of forewarnings as to what could happen to our own planet?
It is smart to not ignore when you see evidence around you that there are things that can be dangerous to your livelihood, right? And so when you know, as an astrobiologist, what I see when I look at these worlds is, Earth is the only place that we can live right now. And that's a really kind of scary thing in some ways, because, you know, it's exciting to talk about exploring the moon, exploring Mars, but we're not going to, you know, move the population of the Earth to any of these worlds anytime soon. So when I look and I see, you know, Earth, you know, as we're dealing with dramatic climate shifts right now, You know, I see a world that is becoming less hospitable, and that is scary to me, right? Because I see we couldn't live on Venus. We can't live on Mars. You see these worlds that are not habitable to our kind of life right now. And so, yeah, like there are reasons, geologic, large scale reasons why these worlds are not habitable to us. But it's good to keep in mind that we only have our spaceship Earth. We don't have anything else right now. And so that's why, you know, we can look at climate, you know, ancient climate on Earth, climate on other worlds. But paying attention, of course, to the climate crisis today is one of the most important things I think we can be doing.
So it's not just that this could happen to our planet, but this is the only planet that we are going to be able to live on. Let's chat a little more about some of the work happening on the surface of Mars. As our listeners know, Amy, you work on the some of the rovers as a project scientist. What is Percy up to since we last spoke?
So we are still exploring the upper fan with the Perseverance rover. We are working to sample one of the areas that we think is actually, this is very relevant for this conversation today. One of the areas that's sort of the last gasp of water carrying rocks onto the fan and the delta in Jezero. So from orbit, which you can see are these different lobes on the delta and the fan. And if you trace them, you can tell this is one of the ones that's on top. And some of the principles of geology can tell us that the thing that's on top is almost certainly younger than the stuff below it. So we're working on sampling some of those youngest deposits. And by returning samples like that to Earth, you know, we can get, like I talked about, that absolute age on those rocks. And it'll start to help us understand, you know, or at least bracket when were these samples, or sorry, these rocks being brought in, the ones that we're sampling, and tell us a bit more about when water was maybe starting to slow down on Mars.
Was this area something that had always been on your list to survey from what you had seen from orbit, or was this an area discovered from being on the ground?
I think you could say it's a combination. Because yeah, you know, we know what we're going to drive up onto the delta and the fan and move up and out of Jezero eventually. And so we knew from orbit that this was one of the younger areas, but you know, it's always when you get on the ground with the rover eyes and you look around and you say, all right, this is a really compelling outcrop. We can tell the size of the grains. That means that we know how fast the water was that brought those little grains into the delta and into the crater, you know, billions of years ago. And so having that kind of context, again, is what makes Mars sample returns so powerful, because now we know where these are from, that they are young. There's so many questions we can answer with such a simple little rock.
And finally, Amy, I know we talk a lot about Percy, but let's give Curiosity a little bit of love on the show. What is that rover up to these days?
So Curiosity is moving into these alternating light and dark bands, which we think have a lot of sulfate minerals in them. And that's really interesting and relevant to our discussion today, because sulfate is one of, it's basically a salt. That's a way to think of it. And where we are in Gale Crater is a place where we think that water has started to dry out, and you're seeing more and more salts that have formed in the environment. So if you picture like a playa or a salt pan, you know, like these desiccating areas where the water is starting to dry up, that's the kind of environment that we're exploring right now with Curiosity.
Amy Williams is an astrobiologist at the University of Florida and a scientist on NASA's Perseverance rover. Amy, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, I love it every time. Thanks.
Well, that's going to do it for this week's show. If you're not already, be sure to subscribe to the show's podcast feed so you never miss an episode. Do that on the NPR app, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, or simply wherever you get your podcasts. We've got more space coverage online. Visit wmfe.org/space. Are We There Yet? Is a production of 90.7 WMFE News. Our producer is Marion Summerall. Editorial guidance from Latoya Dennis. Support for Are We There Yet comes from our listeners. Until next week, I'm Brendan Byrne. Thanks for listening.